This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Betty Carter was so often described as one of the best living jazz singers, it truly hurts to say now she is gone. She died Saturday of pancreatic cancer at the age of 69. She not only had a beautiful, rich voice, she was a brilliant vocal improviser, often completely reimagining the song she sang. Stanley Crouch described her as probably the most significant jazz singer since the emergence of Sarah Vaughan in the mid-40s. New Yorker jazz critic Whitney Balliot praised her for stretching time even farther than Billie Holiday. New York Times jazz critic Peter Watrous described her concerts as some of the most moving experiences in jazz. We're going to remember Betty Carter with an interview we recorded in 1990. First, let's hear some of her recent work. This is Close Your Eyes from her CD, I'm Yours, You're Mine.
Close your eyes, rest your head on my shoulder and sleep. Close your eyes, and I will close mine. Close your eyes. Let's pretend that we're both counting sheep. Close your eyes. Oh, this is divine. Music play. Something dreamy for dancing while we're here romancing. It's love's holiday. And love will be our guide. Close your eyes. When you open them, dear, I'll be near by your side. So won't you close your eyes?
When I spoke with Betty Carter in 1990, she had just released a CD called Dropping Things. I asked her about one of the songs on it. This is the Rodgers and Hammerstein song, What's the Use of Wondering? And
right.
It's from Carousel, isn't it?
Right.
Tell me why you chose the song. This is another example. This happens to me all the time, that there's a song that I really never cared much for, and suddenly I hear, well, in this case, I hear you sing, and I say, hey, this song is really fine. It's beautiful the way you sing it.
Why didn't you care for it? Because of the lyrics, right?
I think it might be because of the movie of Carousel. I don't...
Well, the lyrics are pretty much, you know, like most females wouldn't want to sing lyrics like this, mm-hmm. because it really caters to the man completely, you know. But the melody is so great, and I just think that people are missing out on this beautiful tune if it's not sung by more people, you know. And I changed the key in the bridge, you know, which I had to do in order to make it sound good to me, you know. So I think that's probably the reason why you like it.
Let's hear it. This is What's the Use of Wondering, and it's from Betty Carter's new album, Dropping Things.
What's the use of wondering if he's good or if he's bad? Oh, if you like the way he wears his hat, what's the use of wondering if he's good or if he's bad? He's your fella and you love him. That's all there is to that.
Do you actively look for songs, or do they just happen to you? I don't mean songs you've written, but songs that you add to your repertoire.
No, I really look for songs that are a little different, because you can't find them, you know. People just don't sing songs like Deep Night and things like that, you know. So I really go out and look for songs that haven't been overexposed by other singers. And I try to stay away from songs that have been sung a singer has become well-known with. I try to lay off of that particular song.
It's amazing how a good singer like you can take even a song with sentiment that might seem corny on the page and make it really come to life.
Well, if it's a corny lyric, then it's the music I like. And I put them together that way.
Having your own label, did that make you Well, having your own label made you independent, gave you the freedom to record what you wanted to record without a record company intervening and saying, no, add this, sing that. It also made you into a businesswoman. What else did it do, having being that independent?
Well, it just... What it taught me was that I had to do what I had to do. It wasn't that I had any problems with record companies. It was the way the environment was running at the time. Record companies were not interested in really dealing with jazz artists. I wasn't the only person that was without a jazz label. There were a lot of jazz people that had the bigger names than mine and didn't have a major jazz label, a major label. I just thought I had to do what I had to do. I was told by a lady friend of mine in Jersey to do it myself, and she said, do it yourself, and I decided, well, okay, I'll do it myself and see what happens. And it was a slow process because I tried not to sell records on the job. I really wanted people to go to the record shops and ask for the record. I didn't really want to come off of a job and have a stack of records outside and selling them that way. So I avoided that.
Why did you want to avoid that? A lot of jazz musicians have a display of the records at the back of the room that they're playing.
I know that. I don't know why I didn't like that as much as a lot of other people do. But it was just something that I just couldn't do. And so I just wanted the people that wanted my records to go to the record shop and inquire about a record from Betty Carter, and then maybe the record shop would try to find out where he can get a Betty Carter record and put them in the shop. I really wanted my records in the shop, so the only way to do that was to create a demand. So that's what I tried to do.
Now, you sat in with Lionel Hampton one night, I think this was after you graduated high school, and based on that, he hired you. You sang with his band a couple of years. There were several singers in the band at that time. Was there a kind of number that you specialized in?
Yeah, I improvised all the time. It wasn't any particular number. I just improvised all the time. Anytime he wanted to put me in a song to improvise, he would let me do it.
You've said that you would have, at the time, preferred to be in, say, Dizzy Gillespie's band.
Mm-hmm.
But looking back, it seemed like Hampton was the right place to be. Why?
Because it was better organized, and I got paid every week. And it was well run, and I had the role model of his wife that I didn't realize at that time was a real role model, because she was the person who was in control of the orchestra.
This is Gladys Hampton,
right?
Were there ever things that you were expected to do that you didn't want to do when you were performing with the Hampton Band?
That I was expected to do? No, there were some things I wanted to do that I wasn't allowed to do or wasn't able to do. And that was to really sing some songs, you know. But Ham thought I could improvise better. So that's what he had me do.
Did you ever feel earlier in your career that there were a lot of musicians who didn't take singers seriously and who didn't think that they were the equals of musicians? Of instrumentalists.
Well, you must remember that the jazz world is dominated by men, and as we know, men tend to think that they know more than most women, period. So let's not even put it in just the music business at all, you know. But since they did dominate the field of music, and they are the innovators, we must give them that kind of respect. Now, it's up to us as females, and we're getting there now, to take on this challenge and have them realize that we have talent also. A lot of us were really afraid to get out there and deal with men on the same level, but now we're doing that.
Let's talk a little more about your style of singing.
Oh.
You got started, you know, in the Hampton Band doing a lot of improvisation and stuff.
Right.
Now, when you sing a song, you often improvise on the melody.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean scat. I mean just.
Oh no.
Just
The melody has changed a little bit. Like you may have thought that I changed what the use of wondering is. You know, I know what you mean.
How did you start developing that?
Yeah, as you get older, your voice does change. And if you don't want to change keys, you better do something. You know? If you don't want to drop your key, then you'd better know what to do to compensate and keeping it in the same key. For instance, a lot of the songs I sing today are in the same key I sang them in 25 years ago. So I can't, my voice isn't as thin and as light as it was 25 years ago. It's heavier, it's thicker. So I have to challenge myself now. What can I do to compensate for all these things? So in order to, and then by doing that, you only educate yourself and you learn more about you, what you can, your capabilities, what you can do. And you find that you can do a whole lot of things. The breathing becomes different. Holding notes become different. Going from high to low becomes different. So you have to adjust to this. There's one song that I have been wanting to do for years, and the only way I'm going to ever do this song is to change key. And I refuse to do it because I don't want to change keys. I'm just stubborn enough to not want to change keys.
Well, what's wrong with changing keys? Why are you so attached to one key? Do you see it as a, because as a failure?
It's because it's brighter. I think that what it's done for me is make me fight for my sound. It makes me fight for my throat, for my to be a better singer, to be a stronger singer. If I adjust, I'm making it easy for myself. So if I change keys, I'm making it easier for myself. So if I don't change keys, I've got to reach for something. So this keeps me reaching for something.
Let's pause here and listen to one of Betty Carter's early recordings from 1955. This is Can't We Be Friends?
I thought I'd found a man of my dreams. Now it seems this is how the story ends. He's gonna turn me down and say, can't we be friends? Thought for once I couldn't go wrong. Not for long, I can see the way this ends. He's gonna turn me down and say, can't we be friends? Never again. Through with love, through with men. They play their game without shame, and who's to blame? Thought I'd find a man I could trust. What a bust. This is how the story ends. He's gonna turn me down and say, can't we be friends?
We'll hear more of our 1990 interview with Betty Carter after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening back to a 1990 interview with jazz singer Betty Carter. She died of pancreatic cancer on Saturday. A couple of years ago, an album was reissued that was a real collector's item in the jazz world. I mean, I'm thinking of the album of duets you recorded with Ray Charles.
Right.
To give our listeners a sense of how much in demand this was, I mean, the most beat up, unlistenable copy of it would sell for like $60 or $80.
You know? That was terrible.
Yeah.
That was terrible. Awful.
So you know, now it's available on CD and on record again. What was your reaction when it was brought out? And I'm wondering if you were consulted. And
I wasn't consulted because, you know, I recorded this album in 1960 with Ray Charles when I didn't have a name at all. And at that time, he did have a name. He had a name because he had recorded Georgia. And you remember how big Georgia was, you know. And I was doing some theater tours with him when he asked me to do the album with him. Now, when the record was reissued, say a couple years ago, I wasn't the person to be consulted because I didn't have any control over the record in the first place. I was just singing the part that he gave me to sing, you know. So, but he did let me know that the record was coming out. He called me up and told me that the record was coming out, on what label it was coming out on, and that he would see to it that I got some copies. And that was the gist of it.
I want to play something from the album of duets that you recorded with Ray Charles. And this is Baby, It's Cold Outside.
Ooh.
Do you want to say anything about this before we hear it?
Well, it's a song that I never thought I would ever sing, that's for sure.
Why? You know,
I just never thought I would ever sing it. And I never thought it would really be a favorite song for people these days. I mean, I really didn't believe it would really catch on this and stay alive this long, where people, wherever I work without Ray Charles, people ask me to sing "Baby It's Cold Outside." It's really weird, you know.
You think it's a very slight song?
No. It's not that. It's just that I never dreamed that it would be this effective.
Uh huh.
You know, I just never thought it would be this effective, that people would ask me to do it by myself.
Okay, well, here it is. "Baby, It's Cold Outside," performed by my guest Betty Carter with Ray Charles, recorded in 1960.
I really can't stay.
Betty, it's cold outside.
I've got to go away.
Betty, it's cold out there.
This evening has been
hoping that you drop in.
So very nice.
I'll hold your hand. They're just like
my
ice.
Mother will start to
beautiful
worry.
What's your hurry?
And father will be pacing the
listen
floor.
To that fireplace roar.
So really I better
beautiful, please don't hurry.
Well, maybe just a
half. Why don't
drink
you put more? Some records on while I pour?
And the neighbors might think
Betty, it's bad out there.
Say, what's in this dream?
No cabs to be had out there.
I wish I knew how.
Your eyes are like starlight now.
To break the spell.
Take your hat, your hair looks
red. I ought to say no, no.
Mind
no,
if I'm moving closer?
At least I'm gonna say that I tried.
What's the sense of hurting my pride?
I really can't stay.
Baby, don't hold out.
Ah, oh, but it's cold outside.
Betty Carter is my guest. You've raised two sons, and I think you used to perform when you were pregnant, right?
Oh, sure.
Was that done much then? For what? Singers?
I think so. I mean, I think Dinah Washington did that. A lot of singers didn't have any kids. I think Nancy Wilson did. Ella Fitzgerald, I don't think, did, or Sarah. So I think the people that had kids did. I mean, we just, if we wanted to keep working, we did.
Were you able to get suitable maternity clothes for performance?
If I wasn't able to get them, I made them.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Was it hard raising two children while often being on the road? As you mentioned, a lot of singers didn't have children to raise. So
yeah, well,
you were in a tough spot.
You know, I really, at that time I didn't think about it. You know, when I hear talk shows now, when they talk about raising kids and working, I start to think about how did I get through that, because I didn't really think about it being very difficult, because I was going to do what I had to do. My first son was born on March the 14th in 1961, and I was on the road doing with Ray Charles for a month of one-nighters in April that following the same year. So I didn't even think about it. I mean, I didn't think about it as something difficult to do, like they're thinking about it these days.
I think a lot of singers probably had bands put together for them, or trios put together for them. You've always hired your own musicians.
Oh, yeah.
How do you find the musicians who you hire? You often find young musicians who then go on to, you know, careers of their own, but you often find people who no one knows yet. No one knows yet.
Well, I at one time used musicians that people knew, but as I grew older, I felt that I needed something young under me. I needed some energy under me. I really felt like Art Blakey felt about youth inspiring you, giving you the enthusiasm that you need to stay on top of things, to stay young and stay fresh. So I started hiring young musicians about 15 to maybe 16, 17 years ago. And when the word gets out that you will hire young musicians, you know, they will come from everywhere for the job.
When you're working with young players, you probably have to teach them a lot.
Have to rehearse a lot and teach a lot. You have to be very patient. But that's also good for me. It's also good for me because if I didn't do that, suppose I had someone who knew everything anyway, I wouldn't rehearse as much and I wouldn't come up with fresh ideas as much, you know. It's like me writing 17 years ago and also dropping things I wrote 20 years ago. And I tried it out with each group that I had through the years, and I never felt... No one gave me the feeling that they really wanted to tackle it until this year. And when I played Dropping Things for the young musicians that I have today, they were enthusiastic about the tune. And because of their enthusiasm, I hung in there and got something out of the tune.
We'll hear more of our 1990 interview with Betty Carter after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening back to a 1990 interview with jazz singer Betty Carter. She died of pancreatic cancer on Saturday. Is it ever hard to find young jazz musicians who know and appreciate songs?
No. No. The thing is that they don't even know these songs to have any feeling about them one way or the other, because when you're dealing with musicians that are 20 years old, the standards are brand new to them. They haven't been overexposed to these standards like people my age have been, or another piano player who's my age. He's heard this song 1,000 different ways, and so he knows it up and down. This young piano player will come at this tune in a different way from the back door because he doesn't know it.
You strike me as someone who's never allowed themselves to be a victim. And I bring that up because I think, I think a lot of great artists have led tragic lives, have been the victim of either bad management or drugs or just something that either killed them or made them very weak. And you just strike me as someone who's always been kind of strong and independent and has taken charge of things.
Well, you can say that I've pretty much taken charge of my career because I relied on people, on the audience. When they appreciate what I do and appreciated in the past what I did, I decided that that was the way I was going to go. I wasn't ever going to let them down. So whenever I got on the stage, I decided to do a job. I wanted them to be pleased. I wanted them to be satisfied and to have a good time coming to catch me work, whether I had a record out there or not. That was the only way I was going to survive in this business without having a hit record, especially after the mid-60s when hit record was the only way you weren't going to get a record label. You had to become a good performer so that the club owners would rehire you when got a job, because you wanted people to come to catch you work. And if you fill the club up, it make no difference whether you had a hit record or not. The club owner was going to hire you. So that was my job, was to become a good performer and to deal with the music also. And I did. I took a lot of risk on the job. And that, to me, was what people like to see me do.
How is your life different now than it was 10 years ago?
Well, I'm a little bit more known, and the records are more available now. I'm getting more money, you might say that, but I'm still a performer. I haven't changed that. I haven't changed my stage presence yet. And I'm not going to ever change that, because that's me. What you see is what you get when you come to see me.
Our interview with Betty Carter was recorded in 1990. She died Saturday of pancreatic cancer at the age of 69.